from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. This is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Guitar, bass, and drums form the basis of rock and roll. But this week, we highlight some of the more unusual instruments in rock, from the theremin to the ocarina.
And we'll review new albums from Maggie Rogers and Sharon Van Etten. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show we're going to discuss some of the best uses of weird instruments in rock. But first, some new music.
Moving slowly through Westwood water, over glacial plains, in a walked-off view, in a walked-off and old me.
Greg, that was a little bit of the 2016 viral hit Alaska, which really introduced Maggie Rogers to the world. Fascinating backstory for this young woman. Grows up in Easton, Maryland, began playing harp at age 7. Grows up in a house that is equal parts classical music and neo-soul, like Erykah Badu and Lauryn Hill. She goes on to the vaunted Berklee School of Music, studies music there, and then NYU, my alma mater. But she was at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music, and her mentor was none other than Pharrell Williams. The story goes she wrote that hit, Alaska, in 15 minutes after a hiking trip, played it for Pharrell. He was blown away, and her career is launched. Now we have a proper debut album. Alaska is just one track on it. The record is called Heard It in a Past Life. Let's play a track. We'll come back, and we will give our opinions. This is On and Off by Maggie Rogers on Sound Opinions.
I'm coming up slowly, I'm high on emotion, with waves of this feeling, as wide as the ocean, and then I see you, when I feel like I'm drowning, and then I see you, it's okay, I'm okay.
That is On and Off from Maggie Rogers from the new album Heard It in a Past Life, her debut album. Much anticipated, Jim, as you mentioned. You know, when Pharrell Williams compares you to a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, you know you've got something going. And that's true. You can see the video where he does that.
I didn't catch that. What is the Reese's comparison?
They're in that NYU class, right, that she's playing demos for Pharrell Williams. Mm-hmm. And he's just blown away by this track. And he goes, you know what you remind me of is a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup combining two things and making a third out of it.
Okay.
A singer-songwriter merging with these club-ready danceable beats.
The electronic. Yeah.
So obviously she had something going that really appealed to his sensibility as this is an original. Because I love that song. I think Alaska is a really well-crafted piece of music. On this record, working with those big-time producers, Greg Kurstin, Kid Harpoon, Ricky Reed, you know, this is a traditional big record company gambit.
Yeah.
Take an original and then make her palatable for the mainstream. Like,
then
you know, what she
her,
does
yes.
already is not good enough for commercial radio.
Yeah.
I mean, she is a pretty good producer in her own. I mean, she did a lot of this stuff on her own. early on.
Well, she recorded Alaska in her bedroom closet.
I mean, and you know, they didn't really have to do much to that song to improve it. In fact, anything they would have done would have disassembled it, how great it is. It's almost like you're putting extra icing on a cake that's already perfect. You don't need more on this record. So they're going for the bombast, the overkill on the production. And I think it really undercuts a lot of what makes Maggie Rogers so appealing in the first place. I'm thinking of a song like Past Life, which is just her sitting at the piano.
Oh, I could feel the change coming. Saw it on TV. Oh, I could feel the change coming. Saw it staring right on back at me.
To me, it's one of the highlights on the record simply because the producers don't screw it up. This is a tentative debut record. I think this had a chance to be a great debut record, but the producers muck it up for her.
Well, you know that part where you said the icing and cake? I think it's all icing. I hate this record, Greg.
There's a lot of icing.
I hate this record. I was struggling with this record. I was trying to figure out why I hated it, and I only pulled the nuclear option on very rare occasions when I forced my wife to listen to something, Carmel. And Carmel says, "What is this? This sounds like the music they play at Sephora."
Yeah,
I have never shopped at Sephora. Not that there's anything wrong with doing that, but that's what she said. And then I realized this is product, all right? And I don't know what you're saying about cake, because on and off, that song we're playing, you know, Drenched in Madness, Tangled Blues. And it's like, really? And then there's the song about running around the block to clear her head in Paris.
I was in Paris and I almost ran away. Two times round the block.
Okay. I mean, I'm not relating. I'm not relating sonically. I'm not relating with her message. Alaska is an okay song to listen to for free on YouTube, but I hate her debut. I'm sorry.
That is Comeback Kid from the new Sharon Van Etten record, Remind Me Tomorrow. A new Sharon Van Etten record. I didn't think we would actually say those words because it looked like back in 2014, 2015, that she was seriously thinking about, if not calling it quits, certainly taking a long, long hiatus.
About 5 years.
The music business. And in fact, she did. Sharon Van Etten, to catch you up, is an artist who started out making demos in the early 2000s. Her official debut came out in 2009, and she walked up the ladder from being a solo artist to a mid-tier festival act in 2014 with the record Are We There. Everything seemed to be trending up, and then she just decided, you know, I'm done with this. For a while, anyway. Took a few years off that included going to college, playing some acting roles, having a child, and then here she is, back in our midst with a new record called Remind Me Tomorrow. This is a record that started with her tinkering with some old demos and working with a Roland Jupiter 4 synthesizer, an analog synthesizer from the 70s and 80s. You probably heard it.
I had one.
Spandau Ballet Records, you know,
cool.
Depeche
that was
Mode
so
records.
Cool. It was,
you know?
It was sort of like the Farfisa trash organ version of a synth.
Right. So she collaborated with John Congleton, the producer, and essentially has remade her sound. We're going to find out what that's all about next, but here's a track from Remind Me Tomorrow. It's called 17 on Sound Opinions.
Thank you.
That is 17 by Sharon Van Etten. The record's called Remind Me Tomorrow. It's the fifth of her official career, Greg. And it's a really welcome return that is also going somewhere new. I think that the rock critic shorthand on what Sharon Van Etten was talking about on her first four albums was a particularly toxic relationship when she was a young woman, and she was mining that for catharsis and self-examination, just like, where did I go wrong and what's wrong with the world? Now, as a young mother, as someone who, she didn't just go to college, she was studying counseling as a therapist, right? You know, she's come out the dark end of the tunnel. And, you know, the words that strike me on Comeback Kid, which we bumped in with, don't look back, don't look back, don't look back, she tells us, watch me run away, right? And that's not running away because she doesn't want to deal with things. It's running away because she's realized the better things in life. And she's doing it sonically in something that will, now all the people who just got mad at me because of what I said about Maggie Rogers, right? I think the incorporation of electronics on this record are organic? I mean, that sounds like an oxymoron. It's an organic incorporation of electronic textures and rhythms. It is not forced. It is very real. It's not like, hey, you know, I'm going to sell more records. I got to do something new. Let me throw in some synths, right? You know, no. I mean, I think there's a sonic texture here that is consistent with also the message. This is a beautiful, beautiful record. I've only listened like six or eight times, and I feel like I've barely scratched the surface. I don't want to stop listening.
Yeah, it's a terrific record. I think 17, the cut we just played, is just a fantastic song. It's one of those songs that you think, well, you know, if this artist is going to reach a new plateau in terms of reaching a wider audience, this is the kind of song that can do that for her. It's a conversation with her younger self.
Yeah.
You know, the adult Sharon Van Etten in her mid-30s talking with her 17-year-old self. And it's fascinating because there's no right or wrong here, but it's the whole idea of moving past that person you were into something new. And the whole theme of the record is sort of embodied in that song. You mentioned the sonics, and I think that is her boldest touch here. You know, she's hit the reset button.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the songs are dealing with this new life that she has now. She's got a stable relationship. She has a young child. And a lot of these are kind of love songs to, you know, her personal life being in a great place. At the same time, there's this wider world out there that is obviously creating this turmoil where a young mother can question, you know, what kind of a world am I bringing my child into?
Yeah.
So those sonics are really creepy, and, you know, there's a lot of commotion under the surface of those lyrics in this song.
Tell me if you think I'm completely off base here, but I'm hearing like Kid A or OK Computer in terms of like, this is what's happening outside. I can't ignore it. It's coming into my art.
Yeah, she's talked about this idea that she loves offbeat electronic music, and she particularly referenced Suicide from the 70s. I think the merger of these very astute lyrics and melodies with these disturbing textures indicate that this is an artist that has not only hit the reset button on her career, but is possibly even getting better than she's ever been.
Both of us enthusiastic about Sharon Van Etten, but now we want to hear from you. What do you think of Maggie Rogers' debut? What do you think of the latest by Sharon Van Etten? Call 888-859-1800 with your opinions and tell us why. Coming up next, Weird Instruments of Rock. That's in a minute from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week, we're giving props to some of the more unusual instruments of rock. I mean, we're not talking about guitars, drums, or bass on this particular segment. We're talking about theremins, didgeridoos, and, of course, the cowbell.
Yes!
Which you just heard in the intro of Honky Tonk Woman by the Rolling Stones. You know, we want to highlight these weird instruments because sometimes they add that perfect, odd little touch to a song that can make it a lot of fun. Jim, you're up first.
Yeah, and that's weird in quotes, Greg, because I love all of these instruments, and I own most of them. I'm going to start with the most famous weird left field instrument of all time, I think, the theremin. The theremin, of course, was the prototype for really all analog synthesizers, invented by an eccentric Russian scientist, Leon Theremin, in the 1920s. There is a great movie by Steven Martin called Theremin, because Leon was a spy and a super genius in addition to being an inventor. The theremin is played with your hands. There is no keyboard. There are no notes, really. One hand controls the volume. The other controls the pitch. And you wave your hands in front of these two antennae, and it makes these unbelievably odd sounds. A young fellow from upstate New York, your old neck of the woods, Robert Moog, started out by building these in his bedroom when he was a kid, went on to form the first real musical synthesizer, the Moog synthesizer. But, you know, the theremin made a big impact in the 50s on the soundtrack to all sorts of sci-fi movies. It was always the sound of the UFO swooping in. And then it became a little more musical in a rock setting. The most famous is Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. Of course, Dazed and Confused by Led Zeppelin. I want to play a modern mistress of the theremin. Yvonne Lambert is a member of the Texas band Octopus Project. And it started, as it does with many indie rock bands who use theremin, as just a noisemaker. Let's add some weird noise into this wonderful, swirling, psychedelic mood rock that we're making in the Octopus Project. But Yvonne really put her nose to the grindstone. I've interviewed the band. She spent a lot of time mastering the theremin. If you've ever seen the movie Theremin, you know that there are virtuosos who can play wonderfully melodic music, sometimes, you know, multi melodies at once, just using this primitive synthesizer and their hands. And Yvonne has learned to play it in a very musical way. In fact, in the song I'm going to play from the Octopus Project EP, Golden Beds, a tune called Rural, there are no vocals, and really the theremin is taking the place of what would be a woman singing. It's a kind of slow, really creepy, atmospheric track, but it really showcases the theremin well. Here it is on Sound Opinions. That is Rural by the Texas band The Octopus Project on Sound Opinions. We are celebrating the weird or underappreciated instruments of rock and roll. Mr. Cott, what do you have for us?
Jim, digging deep to celebrate the theremin. I want to pay homage to, I think, one of the great weird instrument players in all-time rock and roll, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones.
Mm.
Normally noted as being kind of the blues aficionado in the Stones when they got started. He was the hardcore, the bluesiest of the bluesmen in the Stones in a lot of ways, and kind of set the template for their early sound. But in the mid-60s, the Stones had this experimental era with Jones at the forefront, where they ventured far beyond R&B and blues to become more of a pop band. And a lot of the colors and textures in those songs were set by whatever instrument Brian Jones happened to pick up that day and decide to play on. When you think about it, he was playing auto harp on songs like You Got the Silver, oboe on Dandelion, mellotron on She's a Rainbow, accordion on Backstreet Girl, dulcimer on I Am Waiting, harpsichord on Lady Jane, recorder on Ruby Tuesday, sitar on Painted Black. Each one of those instruments, a non-traditional rock and roll instrument, setting the foundation for those songs. But the instrument that I'm going to celebrate that Jones also played is the marimba. This is a percussion instrument, a series of keys or bars that are struck with mallets to create individual musical tones. Brian Jones picked one up one day, and the next thing you know, you've got the foundation for the song Under My Thumb, one of the Stones' biggest hits. But no, here's this guitar, bass, drums band, you know, Keith Richards' guitar, Mick Jagger's vocals, those are the signatures of that band, you think. But on Under My Thumb, it's Brian Jones' marimba. Here it is on Sound Opinions, Under My Thumb from the Rolling Stones.
Under my thumb, the girl who once had me down. Under my thumb, the girl who once pushed me around. It's down to me. The difference in the clothes she wears down to me. The change has come. Under my thumb, it's a squirmy dog who's just had her day. Under my thumb, a girl who has just changed her ways. It's down to me. Yes, it is the way she does just what she's told down to me. The change has come.
Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones, featuring some great marimba playing by Brian Jones. I think that's a pretty common instrument there, Mr. Cott, the marimba. I'm going to give you
one. Not in rock and roll.
Well, I'm going to give you one that's a lot weirder, okay? In fact, I can think of no other rock song that uses the instrument I'm about to highlight. As you know, the Troggs, the great proto-punk band from Andover, England, contemporaries of the Beatles and Herman's Hermits and the British Invasion, but much nastier than all of them. You know, they're one of my favorite bands. I love this band. There'd be no garage rock without the Troggs. Wonderfully ham-fisted, but brilliant in everything they did. And their breakthrough hit with Wild Thing, written by a New York singer-songwriter, Chip Taylor, but really immortalized by the Troggs and then later covered by Hendrix. In the middle of it, for no reason whatsoever. I mean, here is a really primitive, nasty guitar sound, a thumping drums, and the inimitable voice of Reg Presley, right, who can't sing at all. And in the middle of it, they turn to this instrument, which is from South America. Now, there's some debate about where the ocarina really came from. It's a small, oval, ceramic instrument that has between 4 and 12 holes, and depending which holes you cover up, like a flute, while you blow into it, it makes different notes. There have been instruments like that found in China centuries ago, but it is thought that Cortez, of Cortez the Killer fame, brought it back from his encounters with the Aztecs in South America to Europe, and then a handful of classical composers in the 19th century began incorporating it. Why the Trogs turned to an ocarina to do the solo in Wild Thing, I will never know. Nobody will know. But it made this instrument famous. Here it is on the Trogs' classic single, Wild Thing, on Sound Opinions.
Come on and hold me tight. I love you. Wild thing, you make my heart sing. You make everything.
All right, Mr. DeRogatis, perhaps the only example of an ocarina being played on a rock song, and that was Wild Thing from the Trogs. I'm going to try to outdo you. I may not be able to, but I think I can find an instrument that is so rare in rock songs that the person who actually ended up using the sound of this instrument on a rock song had to invent his own version of it. That's the didgeridoo.
Ah, yes.
An Australian wind instrument. I mean, this instrument goes back centuries to the tribes of Australia. It is a wind instrument. It was made out of the innards of a eucalyptus tree originally and became famous for its drone qualities. I think every civilization, sooner or later, arrives at the drone as an essential part of their musical vocabulary. And in Australia, it was the didgeridoo that supplied that. Fascinating sound, if you go back to some of those original field recordings from Australia that have documented this instrument. One of the most inventive minds in modern music is Richard James, otherwise known as the Aphex Twin. He heard that sound. He is a man fascinated not only with weird and oddball sounds, but in creating his own instruments. He was an engineering student in England, and he was able to build basically his own keyboards and synthesizers and percussion instruments and create an entire sound world out of them. Became one of the most celebrated DJs in the UK rave scene in the early 90s, primarily not only for his heavy dance beats, but for also becoming one of the progenitors of the ambient dance music movement in the early 90s. And at the core of that legacy is his song, Didgeridoo, was actually a top 100 single.
Hard to believe
charts.
Now.
You know, there weren't any eucalyptus trees handy for him to make this instrument, but he loved that sound, and he was able to reproduce it by fashioning his own version of it out of drain pipes in the back of a club in Cornwall, England, where he used to DJ. And the reason he said that he wanted to create this sound and put some beats underneath it was that he needed something for the end of the evening when the crowd was winding down, the ecstasy was wearing off, and to create a little chill-out music for that audience to go home by. So he used that didgeridoo sound, that haunting drone, as a model for this particular record. Didgeridoo from Richard James, a.k.a. the Aphex Twin, on Sound Opinions. We'll be right back.
Coming up, more weird instruments. Plus, I'll take a trip to the Desert Island Jukebox, paying tribute, Greg, to a great inventor of another wonderful and sort of weird instrument, as well as one of my favorite songs of all time. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week we're talking about unusual instruments in rock songs that elevate the tracks to another level. Jim, it's your turn. You want to talk about the musical saw, right?
The singing saw, Greg. This is one I actually haven't tried to play because I would just cut myself. I guess that there are singing saw virtuosos who would argue with me, and they would say, no, the singing saw is a real instrument. In fact, not just any saw can be used and bowed and made to sing. You have to buy a special musical singing saw. I don't know how much of that I buy, okay? But there are singing saw manufacturers, and there's been a bit of an indie rock underground rock renaissance of the singing saw, in part because of the Elephant Six Collective and Neutromilk Hotel. We're seeing a lot of alternative country bands from time to time bring in a little bit of singing saw. But in rock and roll, no one has used the singing saw better than Mercury Rev. Deserter's Songs, their wonderful 1998 orchestral pop album, is lousy with singing saw. Mm-hmm. They had a dedicated member of the band at that point playing the singing saw. Again, you got about a 6-foot-tall saw that looks like it could cut down a giant sequoia, and it's bent at different ways and played with a violin bow or a cello bow, and it makes this ungodly sound, not unlike a theremin. Mm-hmm. Here is a great song. It starts with a real solo spotlight on the singing saw by Mercury Rev from Deserter Songs. It's called Endlessly on Sound Opinions. Is Mercury Rev's Endlessly from Deserter's Songs on Sound Opinions, starring the singing saw. Greg, what weird or underappreciated instrument of rock do you have for us?
Well, Jim, you mentioned the singing saw, which, by the way, if I were to pick a single singing saw track that I treasure, it would be something from the Flatlanders' first album, where the singing saw is duetting, essentially, with Jimmy Dale Gilmore's voice. It's, you've heard nothing like it, let me tell you. And it is associated somewhat with country music, so I'm going to stick in that realm when I talk about the auto harp. It is an instrument primarily associated with country music. If you've ever seen a picture of the Carter family, inevitably someone in that picture, usually Maybelle Carter or Sarah Carter, will be holding an auto harp. So it was a big part of the country music vocabulary, you know, in the 30s, 40s. An old-timey instrument that normally is not associated with rock in any way, shape, or form. A beautiful-sounding instrument. It is essentially 36, 37 strings that are played much like a zither, and it can create a beautiful rhythmic bed for a song, and there are also some solo virtuosos on this instrument as well. Cat Power, otherwise known as Sean Marshall, used it as her sole accompaniment on a cover version of the doo-wop hit Sea of Love on her covers album in 2000. You know, Cat Power tends to be a singer who is associated with indie rock and a more conventional instrumentation. She is a quirky singer with a marvelous sense of musicality. And on this particular song, her voice is really showcased by the use of this instrument. Just the fact that it's a pretty much of a solo performance just with that auto harp, you can really hear the musical qualities of this instrument. And I think she was hearkening back to that Carter family sound, that beautiful sense of intimacy and loneliness and longing that the Carter family brought to its most beautiful ballads. Sea of Love, as performed on an auto harp by Cat Power on Sound Opinions. Auto harp is played by Cat Power on her cover of Sea of Love. We are continuing our discussion about weird instruments of rock. Jim, what do you got next?
Greg, my last pick is going to be the harmonium. You know, it's a freestanding keyboard instrument, similar to a reed organ, that you have to pedal it as you play, sort of like a bicycle, to push the air through these bellows. Some of them have a hand bellow. Either way, the air is coming through the instrument. You're playing the keyboard, and it's wheezing and groaning like a asthmatic accordion. It's a wonderfully ugly instrument. I think the most famous proponent of it is Nico. After she split from the Velvet Underground, her entire solo career was basically her on stage singing in those mellow perfect ovals and playing harmonium. But, you know, the Beatles used one. There must have been one at Abbey Road. It's on Dr. Robert and the Inner Light, and We Can Work It Out, and Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. But I'm going to play, I think, the most famous modern proponent of the harmonium, Beck. Now, when he recorded that wonderful, sad song, Nobody's Fault But My Own, for Mutations, it was a grand piano and a cello that kind of made the combination. But when he's been playing it live, it's usually him alone on stage with a harmonium. Classic vintage one, who knows, some junk store in LA must have had one. But he plays it, he loves it, it's become a hallmark of his shows for any Beck fan. This is a live version of Nobody's Fault But My Own by Beck and his harmonium on Sound Opinions.
Treated you like a rusty blade, a doorway from an open lane. Cut you loose from a chain gang and let you go on. On the day you said it's true, some love holds and some gets used. Tried to tell you I never knew could be so sad. Who will ever notice you, you fade into a shaded room. Such a selfish way to lose, the way you lose, the east wasted blues.
these wasted blues. And tell me then it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. Tell me that it's nobody's fault, nobody's fault but my own. When the moon is the kind of outfit, bet I find one that fits. Bet I find one that lights wait for you.
Nobody's Fault But My Own from Beck, solo performance with the Harmonium. We're wrapping up our discussion of weird instruments of rock. We could go on forever because there are countless weird instruments of rock that
this
we could
document.
This
is a fun show. I didn't even get to bring in my own personal didgeridoo, which I can't play, or the theremin that I gave my wife as a wedding present.
Well, you know, the listeners are waiting with bated breath. I think the next time we do this show, we absolutely need to hear that.
We'll do it live.
Absolutely. Finishing up the discussion, Jim, I want to bring the bagpipes into the discussion because, you know, people associate this with Scottish marching bands, and obviously it's an instrument that's been around for centuries, you know, not only in Europe, but Northern Africa, the Persian Gulf. I mean, various continents and peoples have their own version of the bagpipe, and it has filtered into rock and roll over the years. There have been various examples of bagpipes used in rock songs. The Animals notably used a bagpipe on Sky Pilot and Paul McCartney on Mull of Kintyre.
There was Big Country.
Don't forget that guy from Korn, Jonathan Davis. He plays a bagpipe occasionally.
Yeah, you know, the thing about bagpipe, though, I know some bagpipers, right? Yeah. It takes you a decade before you can call yourself an apprentice. It's a hard instrument to learn.
It is an extremely, extremely difficult instrument. And the reason I'm playing this particular version of the song is that sometimes AC/DC, that great, great rock band from Australia, are kind of viewed as musical Philistines, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But Bon Scott, the second lead singer in the band, came on board in 1974, was a very smart man and a very well-versed in bagpipes. In fact, he used to play with something called the Fremantle Western Australia Scots Pipe Band as a youth. So bagpipes were part of his vocabulary before he came into this hardest of all hard rock bands, as far as I'm concerned. Great vocalist and also a great bagpipe player. And by the way, Jack Black did not write the following song. He may have claimed it in School of Rock and did a great version of it, but the original version was AC/DC doing It's a Long Way to the Top If You Want to Rock and Roll, with a great Scottish bagpipe solo right in the middle on Sound Opinions.
It's harder than it looks. It's a lie.
Gotta love those bagpipes from AC/DC. It's a long way to the top if you wanna rock and roll.
I'd have gone with Big Country, but I honor the AC/DC.
That would have been a good choice too, Jim. We wanna hear the listeners' choices too. What's your favorite song that makes use of an unusual instrument? Give us a call at 888-859-1800 or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible on Sound Opinions, we like to take a trip to the desert island and play a song we cannot live without on the desert island jukebox. Jim, it is awfully cold outside, so what have you got for us to warm us up?
It is minus 23 in Chicago. I need that desert island. Greg, I want to pay tribute both to one of my favorite bands, and I cannot believe that in 7,943 episodes of Sound Opinions, I have not played Space Truckin' by Deep Purple.
Yeah.
But I also want to pay tribute to an inventor. Alan Robert Perlman died just earlier this month in January. He was 93 years old. Listen to those initials. Alan Robert Perlman. ARP.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, we've done shows about the Moog synthesizer, and of course, Robert Moog was a giant in the terms of innovating in electronic music, but the ARP was a close second. It's just that Alan was not as good a businessman as Bob Moog, and both of them didn't make nearly the money they should have, having given us the foundational instruments of modern electronic music, period. I didn't know this until I started reading the obituaries of Perlman. He had spent 5 years designing amplifiers for the capsules of NASA's Gemini and Apollo projects, right? And I'm thinking, okay, there's a lot of great ARP synthesizer. What am I going to play to pay tribute to this fantastic scientist, pianist, right? And there was a heartbreaking line in one obit from his daughter. You know, he was in rough shape at 93, too weak to speak, but he got up that last morning of his life and he played the piano. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, it is.
Right, this was a man who loved music, but he was also a genius scientist. He had been dabbling the last 20 years with trying to figure out how to solve global warming. Right? He gave us the instrument that powers the robots by Kraftwerk, numerous Nine Inch Nails songs, the television theme for Doctor Who, all right? But I'm going to Space Truckin'. You know, Space Truckin' is an epic of the early days of heavy metal. You know, Deep Purple, on its sixth album, Machine Head, has this centerpiece song that often, I mean, it's ridiculously long in the recorded version, but it would go half an hour on stage. Mm-hmm. Everybody got a solo. Richie Blackmore is getting a solo, and Ian Paice, the fantastic drummer, has a solo. There's even cowbell in this song. And it's just, you know, it's of course absurd. It's about like how cool it would be to be high in space. We had a lot of luck on Venus. We always had a ball on Mars, meeting all the groovy people who rocked the Milky Way so far. I was in a punk band that did a punk version of this song. I've always loved this song, right? Ours was 2.5 minutes, not the 30 minutes. In the middle of this epic of space stoner rock is a fantastic solo by a man much better known for his organ playing. But in the middle of this outer space adventure, he takes his ARP ring modulator and just begins just twirling the knobs, right? Because the secret of all these old analog synthesizers, the ARPs and the Moogs, is they can't make a bad noise.
Mm-hmm.
You can't necessarily make music with them, right? Because they won't necessarily do what you want them to do. But noise? Oh, yes. Noise they do well. I love Space Truckin'. I love every second of it. I wish I could play for you all the full live version of, you know, in its 30 minutes of glory. But I think we'll just have to play a little bit of it in tribute to Alan Robert Perlman, the inventor of the ARP, dead at 93, and the immortal members of Deep Purple. Space Truckin' on Sound Opinions.
We'll be right back.
Come on, let's go space trucking, Greg Kot.
Yeah.
Deep Purple, my Desert Island Jukebox pick. What is on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, I don't know if we can top that because that's pretty awesome.
Let's just play it again right now.
Next week, the story of Run DMC, Aerosmith, and a crossover classic, Walk This Way.
For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. This show has been produced by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and Andrew Gill. On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Lonnie from Menlo Park, California. Great show about intros to songs and even throwing in the outros. Just, you could spend a whole other episode on that. Okay, so we have Strawberry Fields, of course, by the Beatles, but my pick is In Every Home, A Heartache by Roxy Music. They also do the fade out and then fade back in again. So, gotta love that. That's my pick, and maybe you'll do a whole episode on outros. Thanks, guys. Bye.
I'm Molly. I live in Nashville, and I'm calling in regards to the episode talking about how we wrestle with artists who are morally apprehensive. I actually work in the music industry. I work very, very closely with a lot of musicians, and it has been a struggle getting to know some of these artists who, musically, I very much respect and look up to them, but knowing some of them are just straight-up garbage people. Definitely a struggle to separate the artist from the music. It's really unfortunate that, you know, we have instances like R. Kelly where he gets away with these heinous crimes for years, and these other artists look at it and like, oh, well, if he did it, why can't I? And it's just that's a really, really terrible impression. And this is a very interesting time culturally for music and the music scene. A lot of responsibility for these musicians to be better people. Anyway, thank you. Bye.
Hi, this is Topher from Madison, and I just finished listening to the Buried Treasures show, and I've got a recommendation for you guys to check out. About 2 weeks ago, I stumbled upon this guy out of England who goes under the name Adult Cinema.
It's coming back to
he's a one-man band. To me, he sounds like echoes of Pink Floyd, the Beatles, maybe even Procol Harum. It's unabashed classic rock, but it doesn't sound like he's imitating in the way that Greta Van Fleet sometimes gets accused of imitating Zeppelin. I hope you'll check him out. Thanks.
Hi, this is Blake from Nashville. You guys were just talking about a South Korean band, I think, called Drinking Boys and Girls Choir. I think that was it. They cited that their influences were Sum 41 and NoFX. And how gracious of you not to hold that against them. I can't say much for Sum 41, but NoFX, the influence was clearly there in the song you guys played. Not so much a fan nowadays, but as a fan back in my teenage days, which is probably the perfect age for NoFX, It was fun to hear that influence in their stuff, and I'm going to buy the record of that band. So, thanks.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.